We probably will make a start. Well, my name is Abdullah Said. I'll be chairing this session. The director of the Festival of Ideas, Your Excellencies, alumni of the university, members of the university community, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, a very warm welcome to you to this very important session. I'm glad to see so many people attending this session. There are a few, before I say anything, let me start off by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we stand, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I think it's important to acknowledge that. Well, I have been asked by the organizers to convey to you a few things. First of all, time is very tight. We have until 5 o'clock. These sessions can go on, and we have to finish by 5 o'clock sharp. And that means, unfortunately, our speakers will have to confine themselves to just 20 minutes. We need more of them. We need an hour or so, but 20 minutes each. And I'll be pretty strict with that. The session and the Q&A will be recorded. As you can see, there are lots of cameras here. And the mobile phones have to be turned off, if you don't mind. After the presentations, there will be a short discussion. We'll see how it goes. But the idea is to give you maximum time for questions and answers. We can have a chat and discuss, but I guess the key thing is to give you more time. I'll say a couple of things before I introduce the speakers. First of all, the topic we are dealing with is Islam and Muslims. Often in these sessions, we expect very standard answers, very relatively simple answers sometimes. Often we expect very complicated answers. These are complex issues that we're dealing with. Islam is not one thing. Muslims are not one community. There are plenty of different voices among Muslims within Australia at a global level. The three of us who are sitting here, well, we are all Muslims, but we may have very different views about important issues that Muslims face or Islam is supposed to face. Before 9/11, well, Australians were not particularly interested at a community level about Islam. There were, of course, Muslim-related issues. After 9/11, this became a very important topic. Seminars, discussions, lectures, conferences, you name it, courses in the universities. We might think that the so-called resurgence of Islam actually begins with 9/11. It's not quite the case. Resurgence of religious traditions, Islam included, actually goes to roughly middle of the 20th century in the way we know it. It is a phenomenon that we saw right throughout the world with Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and others. Of course, 9/11 was a particularly important event. Islam and Muslims were somehow directly or indirectly involved in it. And after 9/11, it seems the resurgence of religion is pretty much focused on Islam, which is not quite the case. Our focus here is not Islam at a global level. Our focus is very much Islam in Australia and Muslims in Australia. As I said early on, Islam, even in the Australian context, is not one thing. It is extremely complex. Different Muslim communities having very different ideas about what Islam means to them, different generations, different ethnic groups, linguistic groups, cultural groups, you name it. For those of you who don't know much about Islam and Muslims, well, Islam and Muslims had some connection to Australia from 17th, 18th century onwards. Right up to the middle of the 20th century, we had Muslims coming from a range of countries, but not in very large numbers. It was after the middle of the 20th century, in particular after the 1970s, the number of Muslims in Australia increased quite significantly. Today, when you look at the census figures, 2006 census figures, you will find that there are something like 400,000 Muslims in Australia. They come from roughly 120 different countries. Imagine the kind of diversity that would exist in the so-called Muslim community. For me, there is no Muslim community out there. There are Muslim communities. We are talking about roughly less than 2% of the Australian population here. 36% of Muslims in Australia are born here. So we are talking about second generation, third generation Muslims. We are also talking about future of Islam in this country. Well, it's very hard to predict what the future might look like, but these sessions are meant to explore some of the related issues. I'll mention a couple of things that seem to be important for me when I think about the future of Islam in this country. The first is the very important role the second and third generation Muslims actually make to a number of things in terms of what it means to be Muslim for them in an Australian context, the kinds of new ideas they bring into the discussion and debates, the interpretations they would actually bring into the debates as far as Islamic religious texts, etc., are concerned, and how they actually look at their relationship in terms of the life, whether it is political, social, economic, cultural life of Australia. It's an extremely important role that we are talking about. Fortunately, we have two Muslims who are from that generation, second generation Muslims, who have very interesting ideas about these issues. For them, Islam is not a foreign religion here. Islam is a very much an indigenous religion. Islam is right here. The context of Islam is Australia, its social, political, cultural, intellectual, economic life. It is not something out there. It is something right here. And what it means to be Muslim in such a context may or may not be similar to, you know, some other interpretations that may exist back somewhere else. The second most important, the second thing I would actually mention, and I'll shut up, is basically the when you look at Muslims, you can put them on a continuum as far as their interest in participation in Australian political, cultural, social, and economic life is concerned. So we talk about participating in the life of this community and country as full citizens, not as paper citizens. I would put Muslims on a continuum. At the one end of the continuum, I would say the vast majority of Muslims fit into that category. They are arguing for or are active participants in the life of this country. At a pragmatic level, at an intellectual level, I would say that's the vast majority of Muslims. I would call them participants. At the other end of the continuum, there are what I might call isolationists, those for whom living in Australia as a Muslim is not necessarily in line with their understanding of what Islam is or what it means to be Muslim. I would say there are relatively few of them, but they do exist. In between, you could have a number of Muslims who I would call semi-participants. So basically, participating in the life of this country is not a particularly big problem for the vast majority of Muslims. That's the point I want to make. Now, coming to our speakers, we have here two wonderful speakers who represent the kind of future of Islam we want to see in this country, who are from second-generation Muslims, who have extremely high profile in the community. They write, they debate, they discuss, they put forward ideas, very interesting ideas, in fact. And both of them, as you can see, very young. And they are graduates of this university. Now let me introduce them one by one. Randa Abdul Fattah is a lawyer by training. And she practices law. And she's also an award-winning author of young adult novels, and some of her work on display on the first floor, on the ground floor. She's a regular contributor to a whole range of media, including The Age. She is one of the people, Muslims, you see in writers' festivals across Australia, and she received numerous recognitions and awards for her work. Walid Ali is our second speaker. Walid Ali is a lecturer in politics at Monash University, and like Randa, he's also an author, award-winning author, and regular contributor to a whole range of media, including ABC, The Age, The Guardian, and others. Like Randa, he also has received numerous awards for his work. So what we have here is a very interesting two speakers to present their views on a range of issues related to Islam. I'll leave that up to them, and I'm sure you will enjoy them. Please allow me in inviting Randa to speak first, followed by Walid, and Randa will speak for 20 minutes. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. When I received an invitation to speak, the topic was the rise of Islam and the Australian experience. How does the Islamic community see itself as part of Australia? And how do Australians view the Islamic community? And this was also, these questions were posed on the website. Perhaps you've seen them. And if you're attending this session today to gain an answer to these questions, I'm very sorry to say that you're going to be disappointed. I don't have the answer. And I don't think you're ever going to get an intelligible answer because the questions are problematic. They're predicated on an assumption that there is one discrete, quantifiable Islamic community on the one hand, and that Australians all share the same views about Muslims, a self-evidently false proposition. Even the term, as Professor Abdullah Saeed spoke about, Islamic community is problematic. What makes a community Islamic? Is it the majority members' self-identification as Muslims? But what if that identification is based on cultural or familial affiliation? I'm Muslim because I was born Muslim, I'm Lebanese Muslim, I'm Bosnian Muslim, I'm Turkish Muslim. How do the topic questions address such complexities? And what of the influence of ethnic identification, which is often, unfortunately, how Muslims self-segregate, that is based on ethnic lines, so some mosques can cater to a predominantly Bosnian Muslim congregation or Turkish Muslim congregation and so on. And even in culturally and neutral mosques, ethnically neutral mosques or community organisations, when the tag Islamic is used, are we suggesting that the individuals, that their actions identify themselves as Muslim, in identifying themselves as Muslims, can properly be seen as a reflection of Islamic theology? That their motivations, actions, and engagement with the wider community are somehow a mirror reflection of the Quran's teachings? And to do that, and it's something that the media often does, is to deny the rich, diverse, and complex nature of Islamic jurisprudence. It's to assume that Islamic teachings are uniform, when in fact they are multi-interpretive methods and various competing interpretations. It's much like the Jewish rabbinic tradition. So today I'm going to ignore the topic questions and address the issue of women in Islam, because quite frankly, I'm not interested in pretending I represent the many, many Muslim communities in Australia, nor am I prepared to hazard a guess as to how a so-called monolithic Australian bloc views Muslims. So this is what I have to say today. First, because I'm a lawyer, I have to start with a disclaimer. I'm not an academic or an expert in Islamic law. I'm simply a lawyer and writer who is deeply interested in the classical Islamic legal tradition, particularly as it relates to gender equity. As somebody with a passionate conviction in Islam, I am immersing myself in the books of the past, and I'm overcome by the complexity of doctrines, diversity of opinions, and enormous amounts of disputations over a wide range of issues. It is not to Germaine Greer that I look for my assertion, for assertion of my rights as a woman. There is a clear precedent that a feminist struggle existed in Islamic classical discourse, and there's nothing seditious or divisive about saying this. The discourse on women's rights to equal participation in society is there in the classical texts. I can attribute my enlightenment to the first time I read the Moroccan sociologist Fatima Mernissi's book, The Veil and the Male Elite. In the preface to the English edition, she said, "We Muslim women can walk into the modern world with pride, knowing that the quest for dignity, democracy, and human rights, for full participation in the political and social affairs of our country, stems from no imported Western values, but is a true part of the Muslim tradition. Ample historical evidence portrays women in the Prophet's Medina raising their heads from slavery and violence to claim their right to join as equal participants in the making of their Arab history. Women fled aristocratic tribal Mecca by the thousands to enter Medina, the Prophet's city in the 7th century, because Islam promised equality and dignity for all, for men and women. Every woman who came to Medina when the Prophet was the political leader of Muslims could gain access to full citizenship, the status of Sahabi, companion of the Prophet. Women enjoyed the right to enter into the councils of the Muslim community, to speak freely to its prophet leader, to dispute with the men, to fight for their happiness, and to be involved in the management of military and political affairs. The evidence is there in the works of religious history. Well, how to reconcile this evidence with what we are seeing in parts of the Muslim world in the contemporary age? I am no apologist who claims that there are no oppressed Muslim women, that there are Muslim women in the Muslim world who experience appalling oppression in the name of Islam is undeniable. On the one hand, Islam is clearly corrupted by tribalism and cultural traditions that contradict the ethical principles of justice, compassion, reasonableness, and mercy at the heart of Islam's legal system. In those instances, a distinction must be made between culture and Islamic teachings. Female circumcision is a case in point. Even non-Muslims practice female circumcision in multi-faith but monocultural communities, but the practice is often represented in the Western media as Islamically sanctioned. But what we cannot also ignore is that in parts of the Muslim world today, the ethical principles of justice, reasonableness, compassion that underpin the Quran and Prophet's life are not displayed by some of those who hold themselves out as legitimately applying Islamic law. What we see is a tension between the moral and ethical objectives of the Quran on the one hand and legal rulings set in stone forever on the other. The irony, perhaps, is that our stone age is the contemporary age. Why this is so is not going to be fairly addressed in a 20-minute talk. It's the stuff of PhDs. I'm not interested in simplistically packaging a rich civilization into the trivial, into sound bites and PowerPoint slides. I hope I don't sound difficult, but I think it's an important point to make. We demand of Islam a debate on theological issues in the public space. I am not advocating that such discussions not occur, only that we appreciate the limitations of making sense of something when there is so much misunderstanding about the basics. I hope, as somebody who is constantly engaging with and trying to make sense of the sophisticated, robust, diverse debates that feature so prominently in the Islamic jurisprudential legacy, I feel an enormous pressure. It's a pressure that demands we have an esoteric conversation in the public domain. Because to fairly understand why the contemporary Muslim world is in crisis, particularly when it comes to the status of women, you must have more than an elementary understanding of Islam. And this applies to non-Muslims and Muslims. Perhaps more importantly to Muslims. What are the legitimate sources of Islam, we may ask? What is Sharia law? Who can claim authority to represent or interpret the divine will? Is there a crisis in religious authority? Why? What was the impact of colonialism on the juristic classes? What is it that we want to understand about the Muslim communities in Australia? The motivation really guides the focus of the discussion. If there are some people who fear Muslims because of September 11 and the Bali bombings and so on, do we want to unpackage Islam's position on terrorism, on jihad? Okay, well, we first must understand, how are legal rulings determined? Who determines them? Is there plurality? What are the sources upon which the legal rulings are based? These are the issues Muslim communities are grappling with now and in the past. Let me give you a very simple example. I've given many talks, and one common tendency is to judge Islam through Christian lens and paradigms, so that Islam's institutional structure is assumed to have a papacy or some similar hierarchical organisation. There is a fundamental difference. There is no church in Islam, and no person embodies God's divine authority. Unlike the Catholic Church, for example, Islam has no priesthood or institutional church as a repository of divine authority. Islam is represented not by an individual or body of individuals, but by texts, which must be interpreted. There is no authoritative centre other than God and the Prophet, and both God and the Prophet are represented by texts. You have the Quran on the one hand, and the Sunnah Hadith, the traditions and sayings, documented sayings of the Prophet. Muslims may strive to discover the divine will, but no one has the authority to lay exclusive claim to it. While Muslims all accept that the Quran is the literal word of God, there is debate over which sayings of the Prophet are authentic, unreliable, or just plain fabricated. And there is a sophisticated methodology in Islamic jurisprudence for assessing the authenticity of these sayings. And I want to give you an example so that you can put this in context. The recent laws in Afghanistan, which effectively stipulated that women cannot refuse to have sexual intercourse with their husbands and can only seek work, education, or visit the doctor with their husband's permission. That was effectively the basis of the law. It was seemingly justified on the basis that it was a legitimate reflection of Islamic teachings. And so we have here a contest, not between culture and religion, but between competing claims as to what reflects the divine will. In this particular instance, certain sayings attributed to the Prophet Muhammad are deemed as authentic and are being relied upon to justify such laws. That there is debate as to whether the Prophet made such statements, in other words, serious challenges have been made as to the statement's authenticity, is ignored. A simplistic or dismissive way of dealing with this is to say, this is simply another example of Islam oppressing women, which is to immediately accept the Afghani law as an authentic expression of the predominant values of the Islamic tradition. It is to ignore the fact that there is a science and methodology employed to assess whether a statement attributed to the Prophet was in fact uttered by him, and that historically these statements, which are demeaning to women, and most of these statements are used in establishing laws that are demeaning to women in Saudi Arabia, for example, but have been the subject of rigorous debate and investigation. It's very hard to reconcile the contemporary scene with the historical. One of the most important and influential Islamic thinkers and scholars, Khalid Abu al-Fadl, who is a professor at UCLA in the School of Law, wrote an article in recognition of women. And if you'll indulge me, I just want to read this to you. The fact is that Islam neither limits women to the private sphere, nor does it give men supremacy over the public and private life. One notices that the Greek and Roman cultures which preceded Islamic civilization did not produce a single eminent woman philosopher or jurist. Likewise, until the 1700s, Europe failed to produce female social, political, or legal jurists. Islam did exactly the opposite in every respect, so much so that Omar ibn al-Khattab, who was one of the prominent leaders, used to entrust Shafa bint Abdullah as an inspector over the market in Medina. She was a woman, obviously. Moreover, Islamic history is replete with examples of female professors who tutored famous male jurists. Yet the sad legacy of our time is that we have taken women back to the pre-Islamic era by excluding them from public exposure or involvement. A modern scholar, Muhammad al-Ghazali, once described this phenomenon as the ascendancy of Bedouin jurisprudence. What he meant by this term is that in much of contemporary culture, the world revolves around men and everything is channeled to their service. The traditions of the Prophet reveal that he used to assist his wives in household duties, but most modern scholars have not had the probity to suggest that the practice of men helping a lending hand in the home is to be recommended or even required in certain circumstances, except in my house, because I always use that as an example. Most men are content to ignore this and selectively emphasise whatever in the sunnah, the Prophet's traditions, serves their interests. It is well known that women like Aisha, Salama, and he lists several others, were trusted with preserving and teaching one-fourth of our religion. I have heard many times that the doctrines of Islam are essentially uniform and cohesive, and it's something I certainly heard growing up. This may be the case when it comes to Muslims' core beliefs, such as the belief in one God, Judgment Day, the prophets of God, including Adam, Noah, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad. But the more debatable issues about women's dress or inheritance laws or polygamy as examples are popularly represented as fixed and settled, flying in the face of the rich and nuanced debates that characterise the Islamic intellectual heritage. There is lengthy evidence of classical jurists grappling with the issue of the Quran and Sunnah being texts to be interpreted by human agents. The debate over women's rights and status in the Islamic legal tradition is not a simple one, and deserves more respectful treatment and scholarship than the media allows. We still do not appreciate that Islam cannot be reduced to some kind of vending machine culture where you put in a coin for a certain answer and it is simply and instantly delivered. That is something Muslim communities in Australia are working on from within. That is trying to build their base of qualified Australian Muslim experts in Islamic law. The difficulty, I think, is that our internal struggle is in the public eye, and we all know that the public eye does not tolerate that which cannot be trivialised, simplified, and easily processed. When I say the public eye, I mean the media. According to Muslim scholars, a conservative count reveals at least 2,500 extraordinary women jurists, narrators of hadith, and poets throughout history. When I contemplate the future of Islam in Australia, I find myself reflecting more and more on our past, on our legacy, not as some glorified, romanticised golden age, which remains unattainable, but as a precedent for the way forward, as a precedent to confront those who demean women in the name of Islam. My engagement with the texts that provide a glimpse into the Prophet's life, as well as the principles articulated in the Quran, provide me with an educated and intuitive sense that the repression of women is an ugly travesty and seems incompatible with the mercy, beauty, fairness, and justice of Islam. Thank you.
Well, I have introduced Walid before. Walid doesn't need any introduction, so may I invite him to come and speak.
Thank you for that. I haven't done anything yet, so it's nice to hear. I'm going to try to take a slightly different tack to what Rhonda's done, not because I think it's inherently a more valuable approach to take, but in fact, probably not. But just for the sake of introducing more elements into the conversation and then hoping that throughout the course of Q&A and our discussion, we've kind of got more things to play with. I'm going to talk, I think, in more social terms. And I do this because I think that's largely what people want to know. Honestly, up front, I think in some ways that's a bad thing, that the discussion about Muslims in Australia, or indeed anywhere, is almost never a theological discussion. It's almost always a political one. That is the prism through which Muslims are to be analysed, deconstructed, reconstructed, exonerated, or convicted, as the case may be. We are an entirely political species. And I say species because sometimes that's what it feels like. It's like we're in a zoo. These people, it's like these people go past and they're fascinated by this foreign species out of its natural habitat. And that's, I think it's sad that it's kind of ended up that way. The kinds of discussion, or the kind of discussion that proceeds from the things that Rhonda was saying is actually an immensely valuable one, but it's one that I suspect many people don't commit the time to and are not ultimately that interested in. Which is a real shame, because the social and political discussion is almost impossible to divorce from it, and it's almost impossible to understand with any depth or any meaning in the absence of that discussion. So it's kind of with some trepidation that I embark upon this topic. What is the topic? The rise of Islam and the Australian experience. The rise of Islam. The Muslims are coming. It's wonderful. Yes. I'm not sure we are going anywhere, to be honest. The Australian experience. It's kind of, I mean, the reason you're all here, I guess, is because of this zeitgeist. It's because of this mood that means there's so much mystique, there are so many questions. And the questions, in some way, the very existence of those questions is enough evidence of the demeaning nature of the discourse, I think. Can Muslims fit into Australia? Come on, I mean, we've been here before, haven't we? Didn't we once ask whether Catholics could fit into Australia? It's funny, actually, the more I read about the Catholic history of Australia, the more I get this astonishing, vivid sense of déjà vu. So, sort of, because it was Catholics, of course, particularly early 20th century and into the First World War, when a lot of Catholics were Irish, there was that whole discussion about whether or not Catholics took their orders from Rome and owed their allegiance to Rome. Which I've got to say, every Irish Catholic I've met doesn't give me the impression that they could care about Rome at all. But anyway, But there is that sort of, you know, there's this idea of inability to have any sort of fidelity to one's society or any kind of stake in the well-being of one's own society. You know, the idea that therefore they could not be good Australians. And then added to that was the political overlay, of course. Australia was in the service of the British Empire, particularly in World War One. That was the whole point. That's why we were there. And you had all these Irish Catholics who didn't like the British Empire very much. And so what did that have, what did that say about their commitment to the country? And we had a conscription debate. And Irish Catholics opposed it because they didn't want to have to fight in wars for the British Empire. And there was a massive political split in the early 20th century of Australian politics. And, sorry, not the 20th century of Australian politics, but the Australian politics of the early 20th century. It was a massive split, and ultimately the conscriptionists lost that debate in a referendum. So we've kind of been here before. I've kind of got that feeling. And so there is a sense in which I kind of feel a little bit uncomfortable even entering into the discourse. But that, I suppose, is to blind oneself to reality and into some kind of naive fantasy world where the conversations that exist are only the ones that one would wish to design for oneself. And that's not only naive, it's probably a profoundly arrogant thing to do. So I'm going to try to move from that position. My talk starts now. The question of the future of Muslims in Australia and of I guess the emergence of Australian Islam is not actually principally an Australian sociological question. It's actually, I think, I mean, this is arguable, but I think it actually begins as an Islamic jurisprudential question. And the reason I say that is because at the heart of this is the core question about what it means to be a Muslim in any place. I mean, is being a Muslim in Australia a different thing to being a Muslim in Egypt, for example? I don't know, I always use Egypt because that's my family background's Egyptian. There's no meaning to that, especially. But or anywhere, I mean, being a Muslim in Bosnia, being a Muslim in Canada, is there something different, inherently different about this experience? And that, I would argue, actually, is one of the key central questions that confronts Muslims all over the world, but especially in minority contexts. It's about what does their situation mean? The Australian context is, I think, a historically aberrant one. In fact, I think, you are all, congratulations, you are all witnesses to history. The experience of Muslims in Australia has never appeared before in the history of the Muslim world. And Australia's, I guess, not unique in this. You could say the same thing for the US or the UK or Canada or any of the New World or even much of Europe, in that what you have is not a community of people who are Muslims who have taken on Islam and evolved a Muslim community organically. What you have, if we're being entirely honest, is a thoroughly inorganic community, which is precisely why Professor Abdullah Saeed rightly does not like the term Australian Muslim community, because there isn't one. There is one in our sort of political and social fiction, which therefore makes it more real, but there isn't really one. It's not an organic entity. Something like 70 different ethnic groups in that. Now, does that matter if they're all Muslims? Well, yes, it matters, and it matters for a few reasons. One, the fact that they are all Muslims doesn't tell you much about what they think about Islam. What determines their attitudes and their approach to Islam, both mentally and in practice, is usually has more to do with their experience. This was impressed upon me vividly in a conversation I had once with a Muslim who was a migrant from Albania. Albania at the time was under communist rule, and he came to Australia to flee communist rule. And he told me a story about how when he was in Albania during the month of Ramadan, which is the sacred month in the Islamic calendar where Muslims are fasting, during that month, the government would send out its agents with food and offer food to its citizens. That sounds like a nice thing to do, but it's not, because if they refused to take food, then at least in this man's story, they were taken off to prison. That is, the religious practice of that nation was crushed out of it through an authoritarian communist regime. When they came to Australia, they came with an entirely different relationship to their religion, and in many cases, it was kind of, they were weaned off it. Well, not weaned, it was beaten out of them. And so a lot of Albanian Muslims have a relationship to Islam that is entirely nominal, really. Some don't, of course. Quite a few don't, but some do. It's a product of the circumstances in which their practice of Islam was born, really. That's very different to the kinds of communities that we now see migrating, say, from Somalia. So you have these different historical relationships with Islam that are there. But on top of that, at a purely theoretical level, and this is where the Islamic jurisprudential element is important, there is the question about to what extent does culture have any sort of influence on Islamic practice and Islamic thought. On one reading, there's no reason why it should. The Quran is the same, no matter where you are in the world. The statements attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, there is disagreement about what's authentic and what isn't, but those disagreements are not usually cultural. They're more sort of that nerdy discussion about historical authenticity than they are some social discussion about what's culturally appropriate and what isn't. So why should there be? There's just one Islam, isn't there? And that's certainly become a popular view in the Muslim world, or in some parts of the Muslim world. And it's become a popular view among elements of Muslim communities in the Western world. And it's not a view that's entirely ridiculous. It's got something to be said for it, particularly when you observe around the world the extent to which atrocities are committed in the Muslim communities, in the Muslim world, purely on the basis of cultural customs. Female genital mutilation, an example that Runda gave, is one of them. Not on the basis of Islamic text, but really on the basis of custom. Isn't there something to be gained by cleaving Islamic practice from cultural practice then? Well, arguably. The problem is that in Islamic jurisprudential terms, it just doesn't work that way. And it never really has, certainly not in the classical Islamic tradition. Because in the classical Islamic tradition, and this is a very lengthy discussion, but there is this concept, the idea of what the legal maxim in Arabic is al-urf muhakkam, that the customs, that cultural customs have a legally binding effect in classical Islamic jurisprudence. Now, let me be clear here. That doesn't mean that everything that is a cultural custom is therefore either accepted or not on the basis of the fact that it's a cultural custom. But what it means is that no Islamic jurist can, if they're doing their job correctly, proceed to develop a jurisprudence, proceed to develop some idea of how Muslims should be living without taking account, and in some cases incorporating cultural elements into their accounting. Because cultures, in a sense, are systems of symbolic meaning. If you remove them from the equation, you end up with a highly artificial world and you have to impose a new set of symbolic meanings on it. It doesn't work. This is why, and it's an interesting experiment if you've got the money and the time, fly to Turkey and then fly to, say, Pakistan or India. The reason I pick those two countries or those two regions is because there really should be no difference between them jurisprudentially if you believe that culture should have no impact. Shouldn't be. Not only are they both Muslim-majority nations, but they both, the majority of people in both these regions, subscribe to a particular school of thought within the Islamic jurisprudential tradition, that is the Hanafi school of thought. So to put this in really basic terms, in Sunni Islam, there are four really big jurisprudential schools. One of them is the Hanafi school, and it's the most popular school in Turkey, and it's the most popular school in Pakistan and India. Yet the jurisprudence of those two countries and the practice of Islam in those two regions, the contrast is unbelievable. And there's several reasons for that, but one of the key reasons for that is the cultural imperative that pushes itself into Islamic jurisprudential thinking. And this is most clearly visible, I think, in the respective roles that women have in those two societies. In the subcontinent, much of the jurisprudence that emanates from that region takes on a patriarchal stance. That's true because that was true before Islam arrived there. It's less true, it's not entirely untrue, but it's less true in the Islamic discourse of Turkey. And you could perform similar comparisons across the Muslim world and come up with similar answers. What does this have to do with Australia? Well, a lot. Because in Australia, what you have are, let's say, people from 70 different backgrounds. And with that comes 70 different understandings of Islam, just with reference to the cultural element, not even considering, on top of that, differences of textual interpretation and so on. Not even getting into that realm, which is a vast realm. So instead of having a community that has kind of evolved organically, an understanding of Islam that incorporates its pre-existing culture and so on into that understanding and that works for that environment, what you now have is a whole lot of people, and this is just first generation, wait till they have kids. It's like people like me, and it gets really complex. But you have people from all over the world with their varying experiences, their varying understandings of Islam that have been coloured by various cultural experiences, often not entirely aware of the extent to which that cultural experience has influenced their Islamic practice. Because where they came from, for example, Islam was just practiced as it was. There was no need really to try to deconstruct it in this way. And now you put them all together in a completely new environment as a minority, and you say to them, sort yourselves out. That's tough. And then they have kids who don't necessarily relate to the culture of the homeland, but relate in varying degrees to the culture that they've been born in and they live in. And now you say to them, they'll get along. And it's difficult. The upshot of all of this is that on just about every question, theologically, jurisprudentially, socially, politically, within the Australian Muslim communities, there's an intense debate about just about everything. And one of the key questions is going to be about what Islam in a sort of minority context like this is going to look like. Does it look like Islam looks elsewhere? Does it look different? To what extent should Muslims be incorporating the dominant norms of Australian culture, whatever they are? I mean, that's another discussion. To what extent should we be incorporating those things into developing our view about what it is to lead an Islamic life in Australia? How do we do that? Now, that requires quite astonishingly good scholarship, which I think it's fair to say is something that we're probably lacking in Australia. But I just want to finish on this. That question about the extent to which Muslims should be and are and will be and exactly how they will develop a kind of indigenized Islam in the way that they have all over the Muslim world. That question is not just a question that Muslims influence. Because much of the response that Muslims have to that question is not sort of sober, dry, academic, Islamic jurisprudential response. Much of it is conditioned by social experience. To put it really, really bluntly, Muslims who feel that they live in a country that's hostile to them are probably less likely to embrace a view of Islamic jurisprudence that says that the incorporation of that culture that they feel is hostile to them is an important thing for them to be doing. in their environment. They're probably less likely to do that. And so the question, what was the first question that was on that list? How does the Islamic community see itself in Australia? And the second question was, how does the Australian community see the Islamic community? Notwithstanding the problems with that question that Rhonda's identified, they're actually they're inextricably linked. Because, let's put it in sort of John Howard political terms, if the question is, do Muslims see themselves as Australians, that question can never be answered without also asking and then answering the question, do Australians see that it's ever possible for Muslims to be Australians? And that raises fundamental questions about what's Australia? What's Australianness? And my one thought that I'll leave you with is this, that if we're going to build a kind of society that allows for authentic diversity, and what I mean by that is a society where people feel that they can sustain multiple identities authentically without having to trade in some way or compromise on one, then we probably need to think about creating a society where belonging and membership of that society is not determined by some kind of cultural concept. That to be Australian is not a cultural question. It's a civil question. That is, to be Australian is about the citizenship that you have, the relationship that you have, the rights that you have, the responsibilities that you have to your nation and with respect to the government, but not about questions like personal values. Now, that's a challenging thought. My initial thought about it is that Europe is incapable of moving that way, of having a conception of the nation that is not ultimately a cultural, ethnic conception. America's much better at it. They're not perfect at it, they're much better at it. We're somewhere in the middle. And there's a reason, I think, it's not a coincidence, that Muslims in Europe are finding it much more difficult to integrate, if that's the goal, than Muslims in America. That there is greater hostility, there are greater intercommunal tensions in Europe than there are in the United States, notwithstanding white supremacist movements and all that stuff. It's something to think about. And so now I think it's going to give you some thinking music while we just talk amongst ourselves. And then in Q&A, hopefully someone will have a question or throw a shoe or something. Thank you.
Thank you, Waleed, and thank you, Rhonda, for this very insightful and interesting and highly relevant presentations. As Waleed said, these are difficult issues to deal with, difficult problems. They're not simple questions or simple issues that can be sorted out in a matter of, I guess, a few minutes. I think what comes out of both presentations is a sense of the difficult nature of the topic that we're dealing with, and also the sense that Muslims, wherever they happen to be, whether they're in Australia or in Saudi Arabia or in the United States, bring with them, if they're coming from somewhere else, a whole lot of ideas, values, norms, understandings, issues, ways of looking at the world. And those understandings, if you're looking at the Australian context, cannot be reduced to just one few dot points or one, two, three, you know, this is what Islam is all about. Rhonda talked about the issue of women and the richness of Islamic jurisprudential literature and the high degree of freedom that existed in early Islamic tradition as far as women are concerned, and how a lot of those freedoms, gains, etc., were somehow curtailed in the development of Islam, say in the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries onwards. And the the way, you know, the kinds of experiences Muslim women have in a number of Muslim contexts. Again, these things cannot be generalized. There are Muslim communities out there in the world where women have a fairly high degree of freedom and the rest. There are many Muslim communities where they don't have that kind of freedom. It's not a question of just a question of interpretation. Interpretation plays an important part. As Walid went on to link between the culture and interpretation, say in the case of women or being Muslim in Australia, there's a very high degree of relation, very close relationship between culture and the cultural context in which a Muslim, whether the Muslim is an intellectual, scholar, an average Muslim, functions, and the interpretations that person adopts or puts forward. I think as Australian Muslims or Muslim Australians, whichever way you want to look at it, the issue of interpretation, the relationship of Islamic jurisprudence, classical jurisprudence to the contemporary context in which we live in, is important. Now, I would probably, I'm not going to make a commentary on what they said, but let me just ask you, each of you, the question. Both of you actually raised the issue of jurisprudence and how that may or may not be related to the kinds of questions we are trying to do as far as being Muslim or being a woman or being this is concerned. How do you see the future of thinking in Australia as far as interpretation and Islamic jurisprudence and relating that to contemporary Muslim experience and situation is concerned? It's a fairly big, broad question, but reflect on that and say a couple of words, Randa, in relation to women. Where do you see this, the Islamic thought, or, you know, in Australia is heading? I mean, Walid said, well, there's very little here. I mean, I agree with Walid. There's very little in Australia on that. There's very little creative scholarship that is coming from within the Australian Muslim communities at this stage. We rely very heavily on what's happening elsewhere. But just as a wish, you know, what would you like to see in that area, Rand?
Well, there was a point when I was trying to make contacts with Muslim academics, Muslim scholars, about certain sort of jurisprudential issues that I wanted resolved and wanted to speak about with them. And I found it very difficult to find somebody who I could sit down and basically pick their mind on a certain issue. That was a couple of years ago. And then I got into contact with various women, mainly in Melbourne, and they really opened my eyes to the increasing number of Muslims who are undertaking scholarship within Australia about, you know, Islamic law and jurisprudence. So I think that it's increasing, the interest is increasing, possibly because people are realising that we need to take ownership of our understanding of Islamic law rather than rely on our parents' generation who are feeding us Islam with their cultural baggage. And I think because we are mainly second-generation Muslims, we're trying to access the texts, access the classical texts on our own terms, and rather than through the proxy of our parents and their generation.
Thank you. Walid?
Rhonda mentioned before in a presentation about the misunderstandings to do with Sharia in the way that that word used in media. I didn't misrepresent you there, did I?
Yeah.
Okay. Be careful quoting someone when they're right next to you. That's an important point to bear in mind. I'm not talking about media here, but the concept of Sharia, of Islamic law, which is ultimately the product of Islamic jurisprudence. The problem I have with the way the term is used is it's used as though there's some kind of book called Sharia somewhere, and you just pull it off a shelf and just read its provisions, and away you go. And that's a malaise that I see has infected thinking in among non-Muslims examining questions to do with the Muslim world. But I think it's equally a malaise that exists in Muslim communities and not just in minority contexts, I actually think all over the world, that's partly a result of the way that Sharia as a concept has been abused politically. And, you know, I think the recent explosion of outrage in Iran over the last few days is in some ways a consequence of that practice that's been occurring in many Muslim-majority countries. So what I guess I'm saying is that the nurturing of scholarship, of Islamic jurisprudence, it's not just about having a few more people go off to seminaries and train, or go to Mauritania and study traditionally with someone, you know, in the desert. It's about, I mean, it is partly about that. But it is also about, I think, quite a huge shift in mindset from ordinary Muslims, and for what it's worth, from ordinary non-Muslims who are interested in the topic, to start to view Islam or Islamic thought generally not as, you know, okay, what's the bullet point? What are all the conclusions? You know, what are the reservoir of rules that are there? And more to understand the intellectual tools that are crucial in deriving those rules, in trying to understand where an Islamic teaching or an Islamic idea comes from. I mean, both Rhonda and I are law graduates here, and one of the things that I know the study of law imposed upon me, or impressed upon me, was the understanding that the conclusion is not actually as important as the process of reasoning that leads you there. Anyone can memorize the result of 1,000 cases. But now we have CDs that can do that, and I wouldn't consult a CD to run my life. What I would consult, though, is someone who understands the processes of reasoning. It's that dynamic understanding of knowledge. And I feel that in the Muslim world and in the Muslim communities in Australia, I don't think it's significantly different. What there is too much of a tolerance of that sort of bullet point version of Islam, and too little, you know, and too little intolerance of the absence of tools. I think that's the big thing. And if that shifts, I think what happens is if that shifts, then the activity of religious leaders shifts, because they've ultimately got to change. And I think the same thing is true for non-Muslims. The more you view Islam as some kind of list of things, then the further away from actually understanding it you get, and the less there is a demand from those who provide information, whether it's media or booksellers or whoever, to delve deeper and understand the dynamic nature of that knowledge. I don't think you get very far.
I totally agree with that, because I think it reflects sort of the comfort of absolutes, where you can have just a yes and no, black and white understanding of your world, in which we have the term halal, which means it's permissible, haram, which means it's forbidden. And so what you often see is that Muslims just want, and this is a broad generalization, but I think it is something that we really struggle with in our communities, is that we are seeing a tendency to just dichotomize everything in our lives into halal and haram without appreciating the reasoning behind which certain things are classified as halal and the subcategories. And I'll give you an example. In Sydney, there's something called a fatwa hotline, which you ring and you basically get an answer whether something is halal or haram, which just defies belief that
fatwas are us.
Yeah. Which I see is very, you know, it really provides the greatest example of how we have, as a community, misunderstood the nature of how to, the reasoning, the process by which we apply the rules.
Thank you very much. It's time for questions and answers, and I think we have microphones here.
Do we?
So before you speak, if you could say your name, and probably the organization, I guess. We have a question here first, followed by a question there. Yep, question number one. And question number three here also. Yep.
My question
It's kind of complex, so I'll try my best to...
Please keep your question... to minimum. Very short questions and no lengthy commentaries, please.
I'll try my best, okay. Waleed, you mentioned a couple of things to about the way Muslims adopt Islam and integrate into the societies. And you probably didn't, you know, juxtapose it, but the way Islam came into to the countries in the past where there was a pretty homogenous society, and the way Islam is coming into multicultural countries like Australia, America and Canada, where there are 70 ethnicities, I think is, you know, the order of complexity is so much higher. And I think that's one thing we should bear in mind, you know, the comparison there. And there's one...
Well, that was precisely my point.
Yeah, actually. Okay, yeah. And one verse in the Quran that says that in this Quran I will lead and mislead you. And I think that touches on some of the things you're talking about, interpretations, I think, Randa as well, interpretation and, you know, context of the culture within the way that religion is practiced. And I suppose if I'm going to frame this as a question, how can we actually better come to understand that verse? Because I think that's a very important verse, both Muslims and non-Muslims. I know it's a very complex answer, but...
Thank you.
I don't even know that verse.
There's a fabulous statement from a man named Ali, who was the fourth caliph. So after the Prophet Muhammad passed away, he was the fourth leader of the Muslim community. And he spoke about... He had a lot of really interesting battles with other Muslims, intellectual battles about how you derive meaning from the Quran. There was a fantastic debate he had with the Khawarij, which are a group of... what would you call them? They're like a rebel group. Yeah. And their argument was that you're not applying Islamic law properly. Here is the law and you should apply it. And Ali's response was... he said, you need to judge by the Quran. And Ali's response was, well, here's the Quran. Why don't you ask it to judge? And they said, well, what do you mean? It's a book. He said, yes, that's right. It's a book. And it requires interpreters, and those interpreters are human beings. And there's another tradition from the same man where he said that you can find anything in the Quran to the extent that if I lost my camel, I'm sure I could find it in the Quran. What he's doing with that is he's not saying, you know, this isn't anything, like it's just total relativism and you can just read whatever you want. He's not saying that, but he's saying... Be aware of the fact that often the way you read a text has a lot to do with you and reveals a lot about you and not so much about the text. That's why I think it's really important that for Islamic education to proceed on the basis of tools. Because it's ultimately about, when you understand the nature of text, and I'm not claiming I understand it, but I'm saying when you do understand the nature of text and context and the ambiguities that are involved in that and the analytical tools that have been assembled by Islamic scholars for more than a millennium, and you understand that armory of tools, then you start to see subtleties, you start to see complexities, and that's when you veer from misguidance to guidance. You know, and that's really important. And I think if you're not prepared to gain those tools, then at the very least, I think what we should all demand of ourselves and everyone else is that we at least acknowledge that they exist and that we're perhaps more stupid than we think we are.
Thank you, Waleed, again highlighting the importance of this relationship between, I guess, text interpretation and culture and the importance of the tools, I guess. Please.
Thank you. I'm a non-Muslim barrister. And I've come here, like I think a lot of other people, to try and find out something. And I'm struck by the fact that that question, and this is related, this question is related to you, that my question is to the chair, Professor Said. Can you rephrase that title in the context of what these two excellent speakers have spoken of? It seems to me that the whole premise of that question is predicated on... whoever wrote it's understanding of what we would expect.
So it's a question for me.
Yeah.
That's a difficult one. Sorry?
The rise of Islam in the Australian experience. Or really about the rise of Catholicism. There's a whole lot of affairs like that.
Well, you can replace Islam with a number of other religious traditions. Well, I guess we have seen over the last several years a particular concern within Australian community about things that are Islamic or things that are related to Muslims. There is a high degree of intensity about that. I mean, you can see this every day when you read the papers and television, listen to radio and watch television. You really, you know, it's always, Islam is always there. If it's Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, there's always some connection to Islam. But I think as people who are from a Muslim background, who actually consider Islam to be their religious tradition, we do have a lot of difficulties with that intensity. And I guess organizers of this session probably were trying to reflect, you know, the concern in the community. Whether we agree with that or not, that's a different matter. Do I actually accept the idea there is something called the rise of Islam, a resurgence of Islam, somehow an Islam that is going to kind of destroy us as a community, an evil thing that's happening out there? No, I don't see that. I see Islam as like any other religious tradition functioning in the Australian society. People who happen to be perfectly normal human beings, fairly decent people, going about their day-to-day lives, who happen to be practicing what we might call Islamic things, whether it is prayers or fasting or whatever. And when you look at deep down the kinds of values and ideas these people sort of espouse, you will see that they are not terribly different to decent Christians, decent Jews, decent Hindus, decent Buddhists. So I guess the question is reflecting the intensity that exists in this community, not just in Australia, but also right throughout the world, in the Western world, etc. So I think it's perfectly legitimate for a session like this to put these questions, challenge that. This is the whole idea. It's a festival of ideas. Challenge that. You know, go completely against that. We don't expect our speakers to actually accept those ideas, but just challenge that, just like Randa did, just like Waleed did. That's what we expect. The whole idea of the festival of ideas is bring the ideas, challenge them, and at the end of the day, what will remain is what is workable, what is good, what is reasonable. I think question number three was here. Yep.
All three of you said that there are Islamic communities in Australia and interpretations, and you seem to be clear on that. But I noticed too that, Waleed Ali, you suggested that Australians see Islam through a prism of a political prism rather than a more theological one. And I also noticed that you said that the way we should do it is to see it as a sort of understand the reasoning rather than the particular interpretation. I think that's what you were saying, wasn't it? To sort of get to the fundamental. My problem is, though, is how do I as a non-Muslim, a non-Muslim Australian, get to do that? I mean, haven't you raised the bar a bit high that you, in a sense, need a law degree or any degree to actually fully utilise this process of reasoning to get to it? And, I mean, I'm reminded that about 45 years ago when I first came across Islam, and it was in Malaysia and Indonesia, and I sort of made a bit of an attempt to get a handle on it, and I thought I did have. But, you know, over the years, I've realised that I don't have a handle on it. So how can we, as non-Islamic Australians, begin to come to grips with the whole thing and in a sense, relieve this tension that we're talking about, this intensity?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yes, give it up. I think it depends on what you want to understand. There is understanding Muslims, that is understanding all the people that populate what we call the Muslim world or all the people that identify as Muslims and understanding their behaviour and what they do and their motivations and so on. And then there is understanding Islam as a theological tradition. There are connections, but they are in some ways separate inquiries. What I guess I was saying is, if what you want to do is link Islam into your understanding of the Muslim world, then that requires an understanding of Islam that's a little more subtle than sort of headline Islam or soundbite Islam. And that's where you do require, there's not really a shortcut to it. You really just do need to do the hard yards and say, well, I'm going to get my head around the complexity of this. I'm not saying everyone needs to make that inquiry, but at the very half of what you know, half of knowing something is knowing that you don't know something. And so I guess what I'm doing is injecting the complexity into that discussion and saying, look, at the very least, let's just have a bit of humility about it and respect that this is a much more, you know, if you're talking Islamic theology or you're talking Islam says X, you're entering into a far more complex discussion than perhaps you appreciate. If, however, you want to understand the emergence of Muslim communities and what's going on in them and what's going on in Muslim communities all around the world and so on, you can do that without being some kind of theological scholar. But it requires you to understand these people not through narrow political terms, not through a narrow political prism, but understand that these are people. And as people, they have all sorts of complex inputs into their character. Some of them are social, some of them are economic, some of them might be familial, some of them are religious. Some of them are psychological, who knows? I mean, I can't deconstruct a human being for you. But they're immensely complex. We are very complex organisms. And what I guess I would like to see is a bit more of a recognition of that complexity when engaging with people that we think are foreign, not just Muslims, but anyone. Because we have this wonderful capacity for complexifying ourselves and our community and our in-group. And you see this, whenever there's a serial killer within our society, we try to deconstruct them psychologically. Oh, were they abused as children? Or, you know, you can see this sort of process of deconstruction going on. But the minute that serial killer is, I don't know, from a Sudanese background or something, suddenly this is just, this is just being Sudanese. This is just, you know, what he does proceeds from who he is. I mean, that's a fairly, I'm simplifying it, but I guess what I'm saying is, I'm not going to present to you, okay, here is how to fit an understanding of very complex phenomena into the 5 spare minutes you have every day. I'm not going to offer you that because I think it's impossible. But at the very least, understand the complexity that we're taking on. And if we understood that, I think there would be a bit more reticence in the discussion. There'd be a bit more humility in the discussion. And what that would mean is we'd actually facilitate a discussion rather than this mutual sermonizing that seems to go on.
Thank you, Waleed. I mean, there's a question at the back, and I will come to you next and then you. Please keep the questions fairly short because we have, 12 minutes left.
Can I hear? Abdullah, thanks for the... can I compliment these people and sort of...
Please, yes. for address the question to them.
first time I hear Waleed Ali and Randa as well, who's... just delivered great talk. Waleed, I just want to mention something to you. In the 70s, remember there was a Russell Street bombing, and in a couple of leading newspapers there was a report about a Muslim or Middle Eastern-looking person who was, sort of reported to have carried it out. And we got in touch with the editors of the leading newspaper, and he was saying, what's the argument about? They did look Muslim, Middle Eastern, and that was the end of that. But I also want to add another, in the context of the rise of Islam at the moment. And I think in a way I'm inclined to agree to this title at the moment, because if this happened today, I think you get some sort of response, if not from you, but there's an array of Muslim people and non-Muslim who will respond to this. It didn't happen in the 70s, and analysis of various cartoons, Muslim cartoons and Arab cartoons, did take place, you know, for 5 years, and we found that 1/3 of the space devoted to Muslims was directed to cartoons. One of the Australian e-line journals, online journals, took it up, but we tried to submit it alongside this book, which you know about. It's called Us and Them, that came out just a few weeks ago. It was dropped. So what I'm saying is maybe there is a sense about the rise of Islam in the Australian experience at the moment, but there was a silence of Islam in the 70s. I don't know if you want to make a comment about that.
Thank you.
I'm happy to take that as a comment.
Thanks. So it was a comment. So the next question here, followed by, and then I.
Hello. I don't actually have a question. I just want to say that I went to Malaysia and married and lived in a Muslim family. I've since come back. It's been a long story, but yes, just two comments. That feeling of perhaps of being in a zoo, of not always being understood. I feel that having come back to Australia, I feel that there is a great pressure to conform and a fear sometimes of the unknown or the unfamiliar. And it's very important that we can be an open society and maybe we can be more like the United States as compared with Europe, the point that Walid Ali was making. We are a young and flexible society. And I think this festival of ideas is one of the things that's good, that these issues are being aired and that we are seeing people and we can relate as people to people. And it's just so important that we have people like this who are articulate and here today and to be able to present their view, the we and us, or the we can be us. Okay.
Thank you. I guess that's just a comment.
Well, can I just say quickly? I just want to clarify. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that Australia should become America. I'm just making the general point. It comes back to the first point you make about the pressure to conform. That pressure to conform is at its highest where the conception of the nation is narrow. And that conception of the nation is narrow. Where it is constructed as an identity that is ethnic, cultural, linguistic, and religious, and the nations of Europe were that because of the way they emerged after the Treaty of Westphalia. The US is slightly different because of the way that it formed. It's a lot of problems in the US that I don't particularly want to import here. But it's more. I'm just not focusing on that specific question about what do we mean by membership of our society. And the way we define that ultimately determines who comes in it and what level of conformity we end up demanding from people. I don't think demanding conformity as a rule is a very good thing. The communists tried that and it didn't work very well.
Thank you. Please. Very, very briefly.
Yeah, I'll try my best. My question is for Walid and Rhonda. The suggestion is that a community is only a community if it has the same ethnicity, same experience, same legal interpretation. My problem with that is that you've reduced Islam down to its particularities and it can cease to be multicultural. Why have you decided to interpret the idea of a community through this anthropological lens and not through a more, if you like, what you term classical Islam interpretation by looking at one's experience through the divine? This may kind of short-circuit this idea that in order to understand a community, we have to understand their ethnicity. This kind of postmodern fetish, if we keep deconstructing, there's nothing left. There's no two Albanians, really. There's no two Somalis. There's no two anything if we keep prefacing this idea that we should break things down to its anthropological category. The Muslim community then could quite be not what it is, but what its potential is. So the question I'm asking, why don't you give us a definition of a classical Islam concept of the Ummah, one that bypasses this Western speak of anthropology? Thank you.
Sorry, are you asking why I didn't do that, or are you asking?
I'm asking why you didn't do that, why there's a necessity to continually define community through observational.
Because I think that was the intention of the subject, and I intended to address the subject. Now, what I could have done was said, let's talk about the concept of community and let's define it in this way, and therefore had a discussion that was entirely divorced from the topic. Or I could have accepted that. I'm not going to.
We probably could have a debate conversation after the session then.
But what I say is, I think, at some point when you address the topic, you've got to address the topic as intended. And the topic as intended was a social one, I think. It's dealing with a social community and the concept of that community. I agree that you can deconstruct forever, but I also think that there are levels of deconstruction that are socially meaningful and levels of deconstruction that are socially absurd. And so I guess it was just a question of judgment and a question of drawing the line to the point where you were having a conversation that was socially meaningful. If you would like to have a conversation, an alternative conversation, about the classical definition of a community that is defined by the relationship with one's divine and so on, with the divine and so on, you could have that. I just don't think that that was the discussion that was meant to be having, had today, that's all. Did you want to say
anything? Thank you. Randa, would you like to comment?
Well, that's precisely why I chose to sort of shape my talk as well. There's already so much misunderstanding about such fundamental basic things that I chose to, I guess, try and demystify as much as I could about these basic issues, such as where do we get the sources of Islam from. So I think that I too was trying to address, I guess, a simple topic, but in 20 minutes you've got to make a choice about how you're going to do that. And when there's so much misunderstanding about such fundamental issues.
Thank you. Thank you. It's not just a question of misunderstandings here, right here, or in the Australian community. Even if you go to some Muslim community, say Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, ask them just a very basic question: what is the definition of a Muslim? You're likely to get 100 different answers. Unless you reduce Islam to just two dot points and say, well, if you subscribe to that, you're a Muslim. Classical Islam, what exactly is classical Islam? What is classical? What is so classical about Islam? Jurisprudence, theology, or what? So I think this, we need an entire session on that. The last question, very briefly.
I think the title could well have been The Role of Islam in the Development of Australia. I'm of an age where I saw the first Italian migration in large numbers to Australia immediately after the war. I lived in a country town, and every Friday afternoon, the Italian people used to come in dressed in black and stood around the post office, and nobody in the rest of the community went anywhere near them. Within 2 years, it was discovered that the boys could play football and the girls were very attractive, and there was no black grouping at the other end of the street. But in fact, the Italian people, whether they came from Sicily or southern Italy or Florence or wherever it might be, with their different attitudes to life, actually started to make a major contribution to the way in which we all thought. And it seems to me that we ought to be being very positive and proactive about the contribution of Islam and its historical contribution to our society, so that people don't believe the bullshit, pardon me, that's in the papers every day of the week, that people who've come from an Islamic background are really part of the Australian, essence of the Australian experience. And I think the more we know about it and the more we understand the brilliance of that society and what it can add to ours, you take away all the heat.
Thank you very much. That's a very good point to bring this to an end. We can debate and debate about the topic, but I'm sure you'll agree with me that our two wonderful speakers have presented their perspectives on the question and the issues. Of course, we talk about a very large topic, and they have done an excellent job in actually presenting their perspectives. You don't have to agree with them. They don't have to agree with your comments, but that's the nature of the thing. So please join me in thanking our two wonderful speakers. And thank you for coming, and we'll see you in another session.